From the Sky News Centre at 6, British tourists are among 28 people dead and 36 injured after a gunman opened fire on a beach at a resort in Tunisia. Andy Hayes reports.
British holidaymakers say people were targeted as they lay sunbathing on the beach. Gary Pine didn't initially realise it was so significant.
Only when you could start hearing bullets whizzing around your ears did you realise that it was something a lot more serious than firecrackers.
Susan Ricketts is there too.
Everybody just started running in and screaming and the whole place just cleared.
David Schofield went back to his room for safety.
We've done the obvious stuff, you know, shut the balcony door, close again.
There are currently around 20,000 Brits on holiday in Tunisia. Some have posted pictures of them barricading themselves in their hotel rooms.
One gunman was shot in the town of Sousse. It's thought there may still be others on the loose. And the British government's just issued advice to any tourists there not to disclose their location on social media and to stay in their hotel. Separately, near Lyon in France, a man was decapitated by an attacker who also drove a car into a gas factory building, setting off an explosion. Two Islamic flags were found nearby. A man suspected of carrying out the terror attack was known to police and is now in custody. And in Kuwait, Islamic States claim responsibility for a mosque attack that's left 25 people dead. Here's Prime Minister David Cameron.
The people who do these things, they sometimes claim they do it in the name of Islam. They don't. Islam is a religion of peace. They do it in the name of a twisted and perverted ideology.
In other news, the US president described a Supreme Court decision that means gay marriage has been legalized in all 50 states as a victory for America. A mental health nurse at Broadmoor High Security Hospital has been jailed for 2 years for selling stories about some of Britain's most notorious killers to tabloid newspapers. And Mo Farah is to stick with his coach, Alberto Salazar. That's the latest. I'm Lindsay Brown.
Something big is happening on Friday the 17th of July. BCFM and Ujima Radio together for the official Harbour Festival after party at Project Baldwin Street, Bristol. It's One Love. Friday the 17th of July, Project Bristol.
BCFM 93.2 and Ujima 98 are proud to announce the One Love Talent Search 2015. If you've got what it takes to perform in front of thousands of people, then this is your golden opportunity. We're looking for singers, dancers, spoken word artists, rappers and other talented individuals to put themselves forward to perform on the main Queen Square stage at this year's Bristol Harbour Festival. Winners will get a 5-minute slot as part of a One Love showcase in front of a crowd of thousands, plus an interview live on Bristol's One Love Breakfast Show. To enter, just upload a 2-minute homemade video of yourself performing to the One Love Breakfast Facebook page no later than 10 p.m. on Friday the 10th of July, and we'll pick the lucky 4 winners to be announced on the show the following Monday at 9. So get your video uploaded today and show the world what you've got. It's the One Love Talent Showcase in association with Ujima Radio, BCFM 93.2 and Bristol Harbour Festival 2015.
Hey, this is Alain and you're listening to BCFM.
He wrote these stories, which were fictional stories, his characters were, always finding themselves in terrible situations. Some were Satanists, some were the Nazis, some were the period of the French Revolution, and so on and so forth. He built into these stories, which was very, very clever, real people, like in one of the Gregory Sallust books. Sallust has a very long conversation, entire chapter, with Hermann Göring. It's extraordinary. You believe every word of it, because he did know what he was writing about.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Politicians on our TV screens night after night, but none of them seem to have the will to deal with the criminal elite who are fleecing us just because they can. Also, some say Bristol, Avon and Somerset police officers are as angry as many of the rest of us at austerity, with 600 less police officers since the 2010 election. But if they want our support, why, like happened in Iceland, aren't they arresting and charging the banksters who run off with the loot? Or come to that, the VIP paedophiles, who only seem to be arrested and charged after they've popped their clogs. So, as the banksters haul Greece over the coals once more this weekend, seeing how much Greek politicians will let British and German banks buy up before the pips squeak, we ask, who's really in charge? The banks, the media barons and the corporations seem to have gotten together with Europe's royal families and American dynasties, the Clintons, the Bushes, the Rockefellers, to create a modern industrial feudal system where they don't care who you vote for because they own all the major political parties. And there's no elections for the tycoons that run it all. Anyway, I'm joined on the line from Portugal by Charlie Skelton. Hi, Charlie, and welcome to the Politics Show. Hello, Charlie, can you hear me? Doesn't sound like it. Well, we'll have to try again in a minute. Three times we've had a go at that. May try it again a little bit later. But in the meantime, we're joined in the studio by old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and also by Kevin Phillips from Avon and Somerset Police Federation. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the Politics Show. You're definitely here, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. I'm definitely here. It's the summer. Glastonbury started and the rain's falling.
So, the police officers in Glastonbury, what are they doing? Walking around as people are smoking drugs in front of them?
Well, it's an interesting position to be in, isn't it? As you quite rightly say, you know, you can see where the government are going with their stop search and everything else like that. And clearly, you know, things need to be dealt with and, you know, crimes need to be... you know, brought before the courts.
Now, I was slightly tongue-in-cheek, but at the start of the hour, I'm talking really about bankers. In Iceland, bankers have been arrested. Why not here, Kevin?
Well, my view is that, quite rightly, they should be as well. If they've been committing offences and things like that, they should be dealt with.
Well, you say if. Clearly, the banks that they control have been, and it seems that they're saying, well, actually, it's not us, it's the bank that you need to prosecute.
Yeah, I mean, my view is that the chief execs of the bank have certainly got a responsibility for the organisations that they run, and they clearly should be dealt with the same as anybody else.
So how can that... Can you just explain the process by which the police do investigations and bring cases to court? Because the Crown Prosecution Service is involved as well, isn't it?
Oh, of course. I mean, clearly, if an allegation of an offence is reported, and it doesn't matter whether it's at low level or high level, then that would be investigated by police officers at whichever department or whatever level they're dealing with it. It would then be submitted to the Crown Prosecution and they would make a decision as to whether the relevant people should be charged and go to court.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, you're constantly arguing, as I am on here, that actually individual directors and senior managers need to be prosecuted for it to make any difference.
I think so, because if you basically, it's like if somebody sues the police, the Avon and Somerset police, and then the taxpayer picks up the tab for, you know, if they're found guilty, well, that's no real deterrent for bad behaviour, whether you're a police officer or a banker, is it? Because it's the organisation which will pick up the tab if you're caught, and surely it's got to be the individuals concerned who lose their individual money or freedom or whatever, because it's like what they call control fraud, isn't it? If you're running an organisation and basically milking it, it's the individuals concerned who should be prosecuted, not the organisation.
Oh, I would agree entirely with that. You know, when you look at it and you look at what's gone on over the last few years with the City of London and the bankers down there, there's nothing more frustrating than when they're actually getting the big bonuses at the end of their year, and it is absolutely frustrating, and they should be dealt with for any offences that they're responsible for.
Well, we can all say that, Kevin, but you, as a police officer yourself, maybe you can explain to us why it's not happening.
I would like to think I would know why it's not happening. I think you, the same as me, are probably quite cynical, and you, the same as me, probably knows that money buys power, and that's probably one of the issues that comes into it.
Martin?
Well, we've had Rowan Bosworth Davis on this show several times, and he was a fraud squad officer in the Met in the 70s originally, And he likes to talk about the Blue Arrow trial in 1993, because, of course, fraud trials are very expensive to run. It's very difficult to get the evidence. It's all quite technical and complicated. But he'd been brought in as a sort of high flyer in the 70s when Robert Mark was running the Met. And they finally got the Blue Arrow, what they call the Blue Bloods of the city, put on trial. It took several months for the trial to take place. And they were found guilty. Yippee. And then the judge said, well, you've all suffered enormously through this whole process of being put on trial, and for people like you, that must be very, very traumatic. So I'm afraid I'm going to let you go. And he let them go. And at that point, Rowan basically resigned from the Met and said, well, you know, this is hopeless. And we said, we got a message from High, that's the last time we're going to do that. And I'm afraid, you see, if you're going to go around arresting people for dealing little bits of cannabis at Glastonbury, HSBC, who have been convicted of money laundering for the Mexican drug cartels, Lord Green is the head of it, he doesn't get sent to prison, he gets taken into the cabinet as an advisor on tax
avoidance. Explain to us, Kevin, how it works, going from, you know, public giving a police officer a bit of evidence, a bit of information, a statement or whatever, say, for example, allegations being published in the press, as often happens, say, for example, with a programme like the Cook Report, you would find, this is back in the 1990s, a programme would be aired literally the same time as it was being aired. There'd be arrests taking place of people involved who are crooks, corrupt or whatever, that have been exposed in the programme. So whether it's just that information has been put into the public domain that the police have picked up, or someone's come and made a formal statement, an arrest happens, why not with some of these very important people, these bankers, these so-called blue bloods? Because I can remember when we had Rowan Bosworth Davis, the former detective, on here, he was saying there was this Blue Arrow trial up in London in the early 1990s, and the message went out, no more prosecutions like this. My curiosity is, how does something like that work? And then, in order to understand that, we need to know how police officers go from that evidence, what then happens for a charges to be laid against an individual, for them to be arrested, and for a trial to take place.
I think probably the most simplistic way to put it is that the police officers, whatever the allegation are or is, would go out, gather the evidence, present the file, that would go to the Crown Prosecution Service. That point, it gets taken out of the hands of the police service and put into the hands of the Crown Prosecution Service. They will then make the decisions as to whether there's a case to answer.
Well, that's obviously going to be a delay, isn't there? I mean, that actually could allow countermeasures to be taken, particularly if the person's rich and powerful.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm not, you know, denying anything that you're saying there, Tony, at all. You know, this is the difficulty that we have. And like I said earlier, money buys power. And we've gone through many, many years, and I'm going long, it's been going on forever, that, you know, corruption is always there, and you've always got to look to where the corruption is coming from.
Now, I mean, you've lost 600 officers since 2010. In order to stop that, you've really got to have public support. And I think unless the police are arresting, I mean, obviously there are a lot of criminals that are being arrested, and unless the police can actually wear down this whole air of impunity that's around for the very rich, the very powerful, then you're not going to have that public trust, and you're not going to have that public support.
It's always a difficult situation to be in, isn't it? I mean, I will actually say I was one of the sad people that sat throughout the election results in May, sat there watching every result that came in, and by the end of the morning I was severely disappointed, because I knew that the police service that we know was not going to get even cut more and more and more. And it's how we then deal with what we have to deal with on a daily basis, the day-to-day business, without these officers, without the money to actually fund these.
Martin, this is a pretty scary situation we're getting into. If there is this criminal elite that's able to operate with impunity, what does that mean for the rest of us?
Well, look, it's been going on forever, as Kevin said, but of course it's got worse as a result of various things that have been done over the last 20, 30 years to give them even more immunity from prosecution than they had before. But just because the law isn't enforced as it should be, that doesn't mean you throw the baby out with the bathwater and say we don't need a law against this, that and the other. The fact is there's a massive gap. James Galbraith is the son of John Kenneth Galbraith, the famous US economist, and he's an economics professor in Texas, and he has specialised in the criminality of financial markets. And he's basically saying, unless you go in and arrest the real big criminals in Wall Street, who are actually well-known people, then you will never restore faith in the financial system. It's the only way to do it. But of course, these people are powerful. The banks are effectively major drug laundering, the major laundries, and in actual fact, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime, which is mostly staffed by police officers, produced a report which came out in 2009 saying that what's happened here is that virtually all the dirty money all over the world has been sucked through the banking system in one go because they needed the money. And at that point, they were prepared to take money from anybody who got it. And the whole system is dependent on illegal transactions of one kind and another. And of course, the politicians are terrified of fiddling with this because the whole thing could just fall down.
It seems
and
create a
huge. If you were serious about arresting people and what have you, then the banking system would probably collapse. I don't think it. You've just got to bite that bullet and do it because you're never going to sort it out unless you do. But it usually takes a big social change, like a world war or something, for that kind of inherited privilege and power to be broken.
Kevin, just give us some of the details of the cuts. I mean, we've just heard, mentioned the 600 officers. What are the changes have there been, and what are the prospects for the future?
Well, clearly we've lost 600 police officers out of here in Somerset in the last 4 years. That is bound to have an effect on the way we police, what we do, and what we can do on a day-to-day basis.
Response times, for example, response to 999 calls.
Yeah, response times have clearly increased. We have less officers out there actually doing the frontline policing, and there's always been a debate what is frontline and what is not frontline, but the reality is the taxpayers of Avon and Somerset expect to see cops out there on a day-to-day basis patrolling the streets, and if we haven't got the cops there, we can't do it.
Another case which is not good. I mean, this is. I'm just thinking about the banksters and the VIP paedophiles. This does not help police credibility when it seems that we've got criminals walking the streets still because they're too powerful to be arrested. Three police officers deny misconduct in the Bijan Ebrahimi murder case we heard at the beginning of June. Three police officers denied misconduct after the murder of a man in Bristol. Bijan Ebrahimi had asked police for help just hours before he was beaten to death in Capgrave Crescent in July 2013. So, I mean, I imagine the police federation is supporting these officers. We also hear that two inspectors, two sergeants, a police constable, and two members of the police control room staff are going to have to answer these misconduct charges. A fifth member of staff would have faced gross misconduct but has resigned from the force. Now, this doesn't send the right message, does it? They won't face misconduct charges because they've resigned. So they've just basically got off.
I mean, clearly, and the rules have actually changed for police officers as opposed to police staff members. Police officers cannot resign whilst they are under investigation. That is one of the part of legislation that was brought in. It does create issues, it does create problems. Obviously, I cannot comment on that specific case because it's still ongoing. But, it comes down to the same as everything else. The criminal side of it will be dealt with in a criminal court. The misconduct will be dealt with. And if I'm totally honest with you, I've actually said I'm quite comfortable in having any misconduct hearings in public. The regulations have been changed so that they will be in public, and I back that all the way. And this is an example of a case which I would like to see in public because I think it should be.
Yeah, Bijan Ebrahimi was a caring, loving and unselfish, quiet, disabled man whose only joys in life came from his horticultural interests and his cat. Doesn't really seem fair, does it, to allow someone who was going to face gross misconduct, who I don't think has been named, but anyway, a member of police staff, to resign and then just get another job somewhere else.
Well, as I say, with police officers it's slightly different. With police with police staff, that will be dealt with by the way that their legislation is. My view is, as I say, it's an ongoing case. It's one that we can't really comment on, and I have no doubt, as they always say, it will all come out eventually when you know, the criminal side is going to be dealt with by the end of the year, and the misconduct will follow on after that.
Also this week we've heard from a Bradford family, police are complicit in radicalising sisters. The husbands say police have been complicit in the grooming and radicalising of the women. The police were complicit in the radicalisation of three sisters thought to be in Syria with their nine children. Lawyers for the families say officers encouraged the Bradford women to get in contact with their brother, believed to be fighting in Syria, with reckless disregard for the consequences. Say the lawyers told of for the families told the MP Keith Vaz, and it seems what the women have been saying is that the in fact no the people who'd gone over there with their daughters have been saying is that there was very close and heavy surveillance by the police on the family, and they just thought, well, we need to get out of the country. Now, surely this isn't a very good way to deal with the prevent strategy effectively, because what's happening is, although people are, there's an attempt by the police to prevent radicalisation, it seems the total opposite's happening. The same happened, of course, with MI5 and Mohamed Emwazi, who was nicknamed Jihadi John. So do you think this prevent strategy is working? I realise this isn't in the Avon and Somerset area, Kevin, but, you know, is it working?
Well, I think we had a conversation about this the last time I was on here, and I said there's an awful lot of money spent on something that I didn't necessarily think was going to be a success. With regards to what's happened in Bradford, clearly you're only ever going to get one side of the story, and until the facts actually come out, that's where you would be. But yeah, does the prevent strategy work? I think there's an awful lot of resources put into that, and I don't necessarily think it does actually succeed in what it's meant to be doing.
Well, I hope you stay with us for a little bit longer, Kevin, because it looks like we have got Charlie Skelton on the line now. Hi, Charlie. Welcome to the Politics Show. Is that you?
Hello.
Hi, Charlie. Yes, fantastic. We made it by the old-fashioned method of by telephone rather than by that annoying thing, Microsoft thing called Skype, which seems a little bit unreliable sometimes. Anyway, could you explain a bit about your coverage of the Bilderberg conference? So I know you were one of the few journalists that was actually at the G7 a few weeks ago in Germany, in Bavaria. And then you moved on, didn't you, during the sort of week over into Austria to the Bilderberg conference. Can you just paint us a little picture of the contrast between the two big international meetings?
Well, certainly. I mean, there were 3,000 journalists in Germany for the G7 in the most extraordinary circumstances. It was they'd taken over an entire Olympic ice skating rink and built this media centre with workstations and information desks and sort of relaxation rooms, giant relaxation rooms, and buffets and free bars, and it was the most remarkable thing. And they talked about, you know, they talked to me about how they just wanted to make life easy for journalists, and they were providing all this footage that was coming down from the Schloss of you know, the various leaders walking through meadows and drinking their Bavarian pints and what have you. And then a couple of days later, about 20 miles south of there, crossed over into Austria and just hit a kind of wall of police and some very, very heavy policing, the most heavy I've experienced since 2009 at Bilderberg, and basically everything was done in the government's power to stop journalists doing their job. Not that there were many mainstream journalists there, to be honest, but it was a remarkable contrast, and probably for me the most baffling thing was witnessing the kind of sausage factory of news of the G7, where the journalists were all kind of had this serious face on as they undertook this important work of basically repackaging this series of press releases that were being given to them, and taking it all extremely seriously, even though the whole thing looked like a kind of cartoon farce. So I found the G7 much more disconcerting actually than the heavy policing of Bilderberg.
What sort of reception did you get? Because I understand that you had police actually searching you in the hotel once you'd gone over the border. I mean, it sounds like almost like deliberate harassment.
Oh, that was really harassment, yeah. I mean, I found myself with three policemen just in my hotel room at about 1 a.m. And they wouldn't go. They were looking at my passport, even though my passport had been looked at by their colleagues I'd say 5 minutes prior to that and 8 minutes prior to that. I was so checked out. But no, they needed to stand in my hotel room and look at my passport. And they just stood there for so long, and it was so late. I just said, look, I can't wait any longer. I was really annoyed. I just took my shirt and trousers off and walked past them in my underpants and went, I'm going to have a shower. Took a shower, because it was the most aggressive thing I could think of doing, because I was so annoyed. Came out, and they said, please put your clothes on, Mr. Skelton. We need to go and check your car. And then I had to go and stand by my car. They checked it. So I don't know how they thought I'd got past two police checkpoints and done anything of any consequence, but they wanted to do that. And that just made me stand there in a searchlight for about 20 minutes. And that was really, that was a sort of, that was harassment. It was definitely harassment. I felt harassed, and I felt impeded. And, you know, I don't mind having showing my passport around those events a bit. You know, that's sort of okay, although it was done so much that I just couldn't believe they hadn't got an accreditation process. And this is what just really, really annoyed me, that there was no formal accreditation process for the Bilderberg Group, considering how much state money was being spent on it. You know, there was military there. There was military, police, huge numbers, helicopters. They even had their kind of special Cobra police. I mean, it was a giant state-run policing operation, but the state couldn't fork out a tiny line in their budget extra, their huge budget, to do some proper press accreditation, which actually would have saved them money, because they would have spent less time checking people's passports. But anyway, that was my particular bugbear, the lack of accreditation.
Yeah, they, I mean, you know, they probably just enjoy doing a bit of harassment. That's part of it, isn't it? I think that the idea is to drive journalists away. Were you the only journalist that covered the G7 and then went to Bilderberg across the border? Did you see anybody else that covered both?
Sorry, say that again. Sorry, my phone.
Were you the only journalist that covered both of the conferences?
No, there were a few other. I mean, I don't know whether any mainstream. I mean, I'm calling myself a mainstream journalist simply because I was reporting for The Guardian. I'm not exactly a journalist by trade, but there were a few bloggers and citizen journalists who did both and got accredited at the G7. And I think everyone I spoke, people like Luke Radowski and Dan Dix, I don't know if you've heard of them, but so they had a very similar experience of a kind of just a mind melt at the size of the G7, and then then this cold bath of Bilderberg, and it was properly disenchanting to be paid that little respect by that organisation.
Well, look, I mean, I looked at the figures, and the fourth largest contingent behind the bankers, the industrialists and the politicians is the press, the media. There's, I think, 22, even though one of the things I saw said there was 18. Actually, quite a lot of the technical people have also got a big hand in news on the internet and that kind of thing. So certainly the third or fourth largest contingent it are the press barons at Bilderberg. Does that bother you? I mean, it bothers me because it does suggest that potentially that the journalists are you know also part of this kind of swearing to secrecy of their bosses.
Absolutely,
as they
yeah,
go in. And of course the boss of the BBC, Rona Fairhead from HSBC, was in there.
Yeah, and John, yeah, well, and she's got other hats besides that, you know. You've got people like, I mean, The Economist is very well represented there. So you've got people that are on the board of The Economist, like John Elkann, because the Agnelli lot kind of own a large chunk of it, if not all of it. But so they're a big shareholder of The Economist. And and you had the new Economist editor-in-chief there. What was she called, Zany Beddoes, and then but you had John Micklethwaite, who used to be the editor in chief, and now he runs Bloomberg News. So you had the head of Bloomberg News there, John Micklethwaite, but he's also on a senior member of British American Business as well, which is a lobby group, and so he's wearing a number of hats at that conference, and I'm not entirely. Comfortable, as you say, with how many he's wearing, and there's a lot of kind of a mishmash of business interests, lobbying, particularly, and media at Bilderberg, which makes me very uncomfortable. And a lot of very, very senior lobbyists for, you know, the big trade agreements like TTIP are present at the meeting.
When I covered these a couple of these conferences in the early noughties, it was Jim Tucker from American Free Press would go there, which is now rather a nasty magazine, although in those days it was a lot more reasonable. He would chat to waiters, things like that, in the Bilderberg Centre, wherever it was going to be, a few days beforehand, and he would meet up with them in the evenings and get leaks of overheard conversations. Any of that this year?
Yeah, I mean, I got asked to leave the Bilderberg Hotel just after. I decided to just go in, and they had goodie bags this year, so they were handing out their goodie bags. Most people had left, but there were a couple of delegates still there, and I had a chat. Ended up talking to one of the actual steering committee members, or he'd just resigned from Portugal. But you can do a bit of nosing around, but I kind of feel a little bit grubby. I just prefer them to treat the media with just a bit more respect.
If you look at the names there, they do seem to control most of the money in the Western world. Lots and lots of real heavyweight figures in industry and finance. With the media, this is what bothers me, and the politicians almost hanging on their coattails.
Yeah, and the politicians are there. I mean, it was a very this year was a very it was very big on politicians. You know, there were three European prime ministers there, and the president of Austria was there, and you know, George Osborne was one of two finance ministers. The other finance minister, Alexander Stubb, is a member of the European financial whatever it's called, the Eurogroup. They're going to be deciding Greece's future. So, you know, there's a lot of policymakers there with a lot of policies to make, and a lot of lobbyists there who want to influence policies. And I think I don't really care if a bunch of, you know, bankers and industrialists want to get together and have a chat. It's the presence of that many very senior policymakers and elected officials that is discomforting.
Yeah, and I can see, I mean, you know, certainly my experience is it looks as if, I mean, if you actually can see what's going on inside through photographers, or as we used to do, and you've been doing at the more recent conferences, is it's very much the industrialists and the bankers lecturing the politicians, not the other way around. There's definitely a kind of power game going on there.
Well, we saw that. I mean, we witnessed that in action in Copenhagen, so last year, when Sir John Kerr, who's the deputy chairman of Scottish Power, and he holds various other directorships, and he's also on the steering committee at Bilderberg, and he basically lectured George Osborne for about 25 minutes. And when I say lectured him, he just told him what was what. And George Osborne basically listened. And, you know, Sir John Kerr is one of the most senior diplomats of his generation. I think he was the most senior civil servant. He was clearly in charge, and that you just watched the dynamic of them. We took photos of it, and you can see that George Osborne was being schooled. He was being told what was what.
Also, Charlie,
one of those meetings that take place there.
Also, Charlie, the biggest individual single company featured there was Google, with a whole load. Well, I think it was three of their executives there. This is interesting to me because Google at the forefront of new technology. It seems that Bilderberg are very interested in that. And also, they are thinking, well, this new technology, we want to be in control. And also, there's another side of this, slightly more sinister, which is Peter Thiel and his project to extend life. I mean, it sounds like there's a real interesting high-tech end to it all.
Oh, definitely. And they've really taken them in the last to their bosom in the last, you know, last 4 or 5 years or less even. They've just moved in, you know, with Mundy from Microsoft and Alex Karp, who is Peter Thiel's sort of protege. He runs Palantir, which is basically a CIA setup kind of data mining, data analysis company. And Peter Thiel from PayPal is on the steering committee, and he's absolutely. The Google played a huge part in it, and Eric Schmidt is everywhere. You need to look up Eric Schmidt and see what he's what boards he's sitting on, and he sits on the board of The Economist, for example. So they're very connected now, and Google's obviously becoming closer to the heart of Bilderberg, and it's very interesting to watch Bilderberg as a group sort of shift into this high tech arena, and it just shows, when people sometimes. And less and less Bilderberg is written off as kind of old farts playing golf, because it just self-evidently isn't. But it's even less that these days as they've shifted in to the high-tech arena. And look, absolutely, there's all kinds of interesting aspects. They talked about AI, and I suspect they're looking at AI from the kind of
big data, artificial intelligence.
Intelligence and profiling, population profiling kind of way. But there's all sorts of other fringe and not so fringe sort of uses of it. Like the director of engineering at Google, Ray Kurzweil, he's the poster child of the singularity. He keeps going on and on about his desire to merge with machines. I don't think it's wrong to talk about that, because that is. That's on the agenda, the stated agenda of a few of those people. So,
Quite a lot of what these people are up to, the bankers particularly, is taking over. Now, I mean, I've drawn the comparison with tanks and an army. In the old days, armies used to kind of charge in and take over. Now, it seems the takeovers are being done as takeover, merger, acquisitions, hostile takeovers, and using cash.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a big... let's not forget also the hedge funds and the people like, and the private equity groups. And there are huge ones there, like KKR, which has recruited David Petraeus, the ex-CIA boss and criminal, to run their global institute. So they had Henry Kravis there, who's the kind of Gordon Gekko of Wall Street, who runs KKR, and he's there with, his right-hand man, Petraeus. So there are people there whose job is to look at the kind of finance of conflict zones and chaos and find out where the big bucks are to be made. And a lot of them have a lot of links through to the CIA. I mean, we saw Kissinger and Petraeus left on the same jet this year, which is an interesting photo. And that's always been the way with Bilderberg. It's this kind of slightly messy, fudgy sort of mix-up of Wall Street and CIA and other intelligence services. So for the last couple of years, there's been a lot of intelligence services there. People like Sir John Sawyers, who last year was head of MI6, and this year has moved over to his own company, Macro Advisory Partners, because he decided to cash in. He wasn't being paid quite enough as the head of MI6, so he wanted to get his corporate dollar in. So that's what he's doing. And so this, if you look at the list and just cast your eye down, you can see the presence of the intelligence services. Absolutely, the hedge funds and the banks. And they're not just sort of small. It's not just, like, they don't send their representation. It's the very heads of these things go along, like Lazard and Deutsche Bank and all the others.
It was
a very... highbrow group this year.
Yeah, it sounds to me as if maybe the ordinary journalists and politicians, even prime ministers, are a little bit further down the food chain, aren't they?
Yeah, well, it's kind of where I always think of, people always say, well, what is Bilderberg? And, one of the things it is kind of the interface between the big money and the big, industrial and energy sort of companies and hedge funds and all of that, the people who hold the real power, and the some politicians. So it's where they interface. It's above all of that is other groups and other interests. But this is where you can kind of see the bottom of that thing reach down from the clouds, and you can see I'm speaking metaphorically, obviously, but you can sort of see it sort of hoves into view when they have to interface with politicians, and they do it. But so over the course of 3 days, it's not like a lunch or something. It's an extremely regulated set of meetings and seminars.
I mean, and I wonder.
We spoke to one guy who, one of the actual delegates who was there, who runs one of, I think it's Norway's largest public energy company, and he was finding it really hard work. He said, you could tell he didn't want to go back in, and he came in for a chat, and he said, God, it's, he said it's really intense in there, and it's an intense 3 days. or 4 days or something. But you know, it's a big deal. It's a large enterprise.
It's a bit disappointed, kind of, Charlie. Yeah. I was a bit disappointed to see your articles don't really appear in the Guardian newspaper. They're only online, which is a great pity. And you know, but one of them was about politicians mingling with criminals. Now, do you actually have any evidence that the people are criminals?
Oh yeah, well, some of them got, some of them got criminal records. Like Petraeus has just been given a suspended sentence. I think he's for leaking secrets to his mistress. And then there's a Rene Benko, who's he's an Austrian. He got given a year-long suspended sentence for bribery. And there's people actually in there with criminal records. I mean, never mind the people that, I mean, practically everyone in there has had to resign in disgrace at some point from a public office, or, you know, not everyone, but there's a good few. And you know, there's Kissinger's, God, I think he might have some kind of questions being asked about war crimes in various countries.
Well, I can tell you, I mean, there are several countries where Henry Kissinger, if he steps off a plane, will be instantly arrested, and that's for sure. Anyway, we're still, Kevin's been very, very patient from Avon Somerset Police Federation here. Kevin, how can we be in a situation where police, paid for by the public, are guarding a conference like this, where, as you just heard from Charlie, there are criminals inside, people maybe who've had suspended sentences, that sort of thing, and particularly bank. I mean, we've got HSBC sitting in there. These are people who've been fined, I think it was $2 billion for money laundering in the United States, and yet they've got off scot-free. Aren't the police facing the wrong way?
I think it's probably been said already, but industrialists and the bankers, they run the politicians. The politicians run the media. The politicians also run the police service. At the end of the day, you've got, if you look at this country, you've got the Home Office and Theresa May running the police service. So we're still accountable to them, and I guess it's just which way you follow the chain upwards, isn't it?
I know at the Police Federation conference, you were given a bit of a ticking off by Theresa May, weren't you?
It's about what I expected at the police conference. You know, it's we've gone through an election. You reap what you sow, don't you? And the voters have gone out there. They've voted this government back into power. The police service expected to get the kicking that we got as per usual. And I don't think anything is going to change. I think Theresa May will continue to have a go at the police service. We know that she's got another 5 years to play with us, and it's just a bit like a kitten with a mouse, isn't it?
Also, Charlie, it's well worth mentioning, there was a very different style of policing here in Britain at Watford 2 years ago when Bilderberg were here, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah. That was quite, you know, it was heartwarming to see the not just the mainstream media who turned out in droves, but we had 2,000 people in a field, with another 2,000 being turned away, and those are the police numbers. So that's 4,000 people turned up, which is, you know, definitely unprecedented in the history of Bilderberg watching. You know, numbers have quietened down a bit since then, but you know, it's the perceptions and the rhetoric in the mainstream media is definitely changing for the better, and it's being taken much more seriously. And you know, it's been taken seriously finally by you know, things like the BBC. They did a dreadful piece on the Sunday Politics, but actually online they did quite a good crunch of the numbers, and quite a few of the newspapers did fairly straightforward kind of analyses of the list, which we haven't had really before. So that's that was all to the positive. So things are changing. You know, maybe we haven't got 4,000 people, but you know, we had a protest march in the town of Telf, which had about 500 people there. So, you know, 500 is not bad. And, you know, did get some coverage, and quite a lot of coverage in the Austrian press. So, but maybe the British press didn't actually bother to send anyone particularly there. But, you know, they still, the rhetoric is changing for the better. And, you know, finally it's being taken a bit more seriously, because when you look at it, you know it's being taken seriously by everyone there and by the police outside, incredibly seriously. You know, they shut down the airspace. You know, they had a military radar station there, a couple. You know, that's how seriously they're taking it. So, it's fine. It's good when the media finally kind of digs down and realises, yes, OK, there's a thing we can actually talk about in serious terms.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I'll be talking a couple of times here about industrial feudalism. I mean, what with the royalty as well, it doesn't take a lot of a leap of imagination to see this as a kind of Sheriff of Nottingham style feudal days where actually they're completely invulnerable as a king would be. You know, no one's going to elect a king.
Well, Charlie will remember the speech I made at Bilderberg, the protest at Bilderberg in Watford, where in actual fact the police were very supportive of our protest. It depends where you are. In Catalonia, the police were also very friendly to the protesters. Austria, obviously, there's something going on there. But one of the speeches I made at Bilderberg, I pointed out that Fernando Imposimato, who is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, the senior judge in Italy, who had published a book which came out in 2012, called La Repubblica dei Strani Impuni, the Republic of the Unpunished Massacres, basically saying that the intelligence services and NATO intelligence services in particular were responsible for terrorist activity in Italy of the 70s and the 80s. And he was the investigating magistrate on many of these incidents, the Bologna bombing, etc. And he spoke in Corriere della Sera the week before the Bilderberg conference in Watford, saying, well, we think Bilderberg are the terrorists. He's the head of the Italian judiciary. And, of course, you're not going to read about that in the Daily Mail, are you?
Charlie, I wonder if you think that there's, from your point of view, if you think that there's a connection between the Bilderbergers and a lot of the sort of conflict that we've seen in the world. Because, I mean, certainly one of the things I would say, you've got to look at some of the arms firms, I mean, the EADS and representatives from BAE Systems that go to these meetings. They seem to be quite wedded in with the ideology of expansionism, of NATO moving east into Eastern Europe up to the Russian border. And they're also quite interested in expanding and getting energy resources from the Middle East. What are your thoughts on that angle to the Bilderberg? And because they're very connected up with the NATO countries and that sort of expansionist attitude.
Well, yeah, well, we've had the head of NATO at Bilderberg. I say we. The head of NATO has gone to the Bilderberg conferences for the last 2 years. So, in Copenhagen, they had the head of the Allied Supreme Command.
Well, I mean, the just American to interrupt General. You, sorry, but I was looking at some research which said actually every head of NATO since the 1970s has been to a Bilderberg conference before they've become the head of NATO. So it seems like there's a way of introducing the person who's about to be made the head of NATO to some of the politicians and that kind of thing. But anyway, it does look as if this is part of a kind of expansionist empire. And I suppose I go back to saying, is this something feudal about all this?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right about EADS as well. They're a big presence, and as I said, the CIA as well. So you've also got them. If you look at the agenda, you've got them talking about Russia and Ukraine and that kind of thing, and they bring in their experts to do their talks and their seminars, what have you, and thrash out their policies. So yeah, I mean, it's hard to be specific about tying in the policies and with what little information we at this stage know, but certainly you've got the presence of arms companies and foreign ministers and things like that discussing an agenda which is white hot when it comes to things like Russia and Ukraine. So yeah, absolutely, it's definitely on their kind of discussion table, and it's hard to extrapolate a little more than that, and I'd be unwilling to myself. But
okay, fine.
Absolutely.
Do you think they've got an Achilles heel, these people?
Oh, sorry, say again.
Do you think they've got an Achilles heel? Is there something that they're kind of not watching? Because it does strike me that they're kind of dinosaurs from the Cold War, and actually we're mammals. Hey.
Yeah. Well, for now, I think the, one of the Achilles heels that it has, if you're allowed to have more than one, is the pressure being put by the alternative media. And it's just there's so many more cameras and blogs and Instagram pictures and YouTube channels being pointed at this meeting, and so much more kind of peripheral alternative. I mean, I say peripheral, but it's becoming more of the most important area of debate. or rather the place where the debate happens, in the alternative media. So I would say that that's one thing they find quite hard, I think, to control. And, you know, young people are interested in it as a subject, and everyone's making their little films and their movies and putting it out, and it's getting watched and talked about. And so I would say that the way that the, you know, all my pieces are, you know, 90% of them are just on the Guardian website. But, you know, that has huge reach, and it's, you know, pinged out to, you know, to everyone that's got a laptop and an internet connection. They can have a look at it. So I think that's a weakness of their old, slightly old school, Cold War desire to draw the shutters and have their meeting behind closed doors. Those closed doors kind of are a bit leaky at the moment, and it looks a bit silly when they're hiding behind newspapers and tinted windows as they zoom in. That all does smack of the 1950s and 60s, and I don't think they're really managing to play that card anymore. I hope.
I mean, the main mission of Bilderberg, far as I can read it, from its inception with the CIA funding in the 1950s and Prince Bernhard the Nazi chairing it for the first 20 years, has been to drive a wedge between Western Europe and Russia. Do you think they're going to succeed in that aim?
Absolutely, yeah.
Are they going to succeed in their aim to do that, do you think?
Well, I think it does seem to be if you look at the kind of the Russian experts and the people they have, they're very sympathetic towards, our Western take on things. But that certainly seems to be one of the reasons why the whole thing exists at all, is as a kind of intelligence service-run bloc sitting over against the East. I don't think that's changed very much at all. But, you know, you have people there that they're much more open towards China. You know, people like Kissinger are very China-philic, whatever the right word would be. That's a terrible mishmash. But, Russia, I don't think, is their favourite country.
But, I mean, I'm going to really press you on this, Charlie. What's your instinct? Do you think that they're, in the next few years, are they going to succeed in driving that wedge? Because, I mean, obviously, we're in a difficult situation financially. Both Russia and Europe are interdependent for trade. But it seems that the Bilderberg and that influence is trying to stop that. Are they going to succeed to stop it?
Well, I don't know. I do know that I'm sure Russia gets a kick out of the fact that Russia Today is probably one of the biggest broadcasters that covers Bilderberg, and they do a really good job of it, by the way. Russia Today, they're amazing in some of the things they do, and the fact that they turn out, they make good reports and balanced reports about the Bilderberg Group is it must infuriate the steering committee. But I don't know whether they'll succeed. Who knows whether they'll succeed in doing it? They're just a kind of, they're one extremely powerful group. You know, there are many, and there are many with a very similar desire to keep Russia isolated, and to keep turning the ratchet. So I don't know. Who knows? I haven't got a crystal ball.
Okay, all right, Charlie Skelton, anyway, thanks very much for your Builder blog, and thanks very much for managing to get through on the phone to us here on the Politics Show.
Thank you.
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Old Abe Roxford economist Martin Summers, the connected to a lot of this is the situation with Greece. The Bilderbergers are really in charge from the IMF. They're IMF people, they're European Central Bank people. We've heard this week that talks have broken down again with Greece. Are they going to kick the can down the road, do you think, this weekend? Are we finally going to get some kind of Grexit?
Well, I've been following this closely, and of course you're getting mixed signals from everybody about what's going on. But I think that there probably is going to be a Grexit, because the compromises which the Greek side suggested they would make in the last week have basically been thrown back in their faces, particularly by the IMF. And at a certain point, they're going to decide that they might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb, and decide to walk away. They're somewhat trapped by the fact that the wealthy classes in Greece and their hangers-on are quite keen to stay inside the Eurozone, But I think that the people at the bottom of the pile in Greece have reached the point of that they just don't care now. They've had enough of being bullied, and they'd rather have their own policy, whatever the cost. And I think that the idea that the German leadership have that a Grexit is okay and that they can cope with it, I think that's delusionary. I think Deutsche Bank in particular is massively exposed to derivatives contracts on a Greek default, and it's quite possible that a default by Greece, and don't forget Ukraine is also in default, although we never hear anything about that in the media. The Ukrainians are being told it doesn't matter if you don't pay your creditors, the IMF will still bail you out. The Greeks are being told pay up now, otherwise we'll blow your head off. But the fact is the whole shebang is coming to the end of the line. At some point something is going to set off the derivatives bomb. As the investor Warren Buffett has pointed out, he said these derivatives contracts are financial weapons of mass destruction.
So is it saber rattling, do you think, from the Germans and from the European Central Bank again?
No, I think what the problem for them is that if they were to compromise with the Syriza government in Greece, then Podemos in Spain, the left in Italy and other countries would be saying, well, and Sinn Féin in Ireland are going to be saying, well, we want the same deal they've got. That's why they can't allow the Greeks to succeed. But the problem is that the Greeks are in a position where Syriza isn't ultimately going to be able to, they can't sell it to their own mass base, that they're just going to cave in. So they'll have to walk. That's what will my money is that there will be a Greek exit from the European Union, which will crash the European banking system and then the US banking system. And this could all happen long before we get to vote for mayors in Bristol or new governments in Britain.
Also, you've got the situation right around the Eurozone where other countries might also crash out, like Ireland, etc. Do you think they're prepared, that the governments in those individual countries are ready to go back to the old currency?
No, people aren't prepared for any of it. But ultimately, you cannot pursue an austerity policy. The reason for pursuing the austerity policy is so that on paper, Greece is not in default, and the same with the other countries. And that means that the banks, the Deutsche Banks and HSBCs, do not have to declare that the debt that they're holding is in fact a failed debt. And so the whole shebang is about to keep up the facade of the solvency of the banking system. The way in which this is discussed in this country is pitiful, because people talk about it and say, do we want to be part of a Europe? It's actually the banking system that's at the heart of all of this. They're forcing the Greeks down this road of austerity in order to preserve the German banking system.
We've also had this week protests in Armenia, in their city centres, about 4,000 people camping out overnight, a little bit reminiscent of the Maidan. And that is, of course, it's in the Caucasus, which is right in between Iran, Turkey and Russia.
Well, I visited Armenia in the 1990s because, of course, they had a terrible earthquake.
You've been everywhere.
I haven't been everywhere. I've been to Armenia, and not many people have. And it was a terrible mess. There's only one flight a week in there. It could very well be that the Western powers are looking to create because Armenia currently is aligned with the Russians. So, and the same with the Macedonian government.
Well, why don't the Russians try and reduce their electricity prices and so people don't have to come out on the streets?
Well, the problem is that electricity prices are very sensitive in any country, because it's people and Armenia, it gets very cold. But it's the infrastructure of diversification of energy supply just hasn't been put in place. I mean, in a different universe, we would all be progressing sensibly towards, creating an infrastructure for energy supply which guaranteed everybody, including the poorest, access to energy. But of course, that's not the case, and we've got a huge, basically geopolitical manipulations going on there. I'm sure that people have genuine grievances in Armenia as they did in Ukraine.
Another massive story this week is we had the UN report on the war crimes in Gaza last year. I mean, that's pretty horrific. Amazing interview with Krishnan Gurumurthy on Channel 4 News with Mark Regev from the Israelis, basically saying, sorry guys, even though we killed 551 children.
Well, indeed. And the other interesting thing, which you haven't mentioned, which is a bit of a diversion, is that the head of the Rwandan intelligence services has been arrested by the British police because he was visiting Britain as a war criminal. And guess who he was visiting? The head of MI6.
Ah, but Tony Blair hasn't been.
No.
Anyway, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights, we hope. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM Tuesdays at noon. This week you can hear about Bristol's secretive Christian sect, the Exclusive Brethren. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, Labour Councillor for Bedminster, possible candidate for Mayor, Mark Bradshaw. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. You can catch this programme online at thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for Friday Drive Time. The Politics Show, 5 o'clock next week. Don't let the banksters get you down.
Live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, British tourists near the scene of a terror attack in Tunisia are being told to remain indoors and not give away their exact location on social media. One gunman was shot dead earlier after 37 people were killed in the town of Sousse. Gary Pine was on the beach when the gunfire started.
Over to our left, about 100 yards or so away, we thought what was firecrackers going off. You could see quite quickly the panic that was starting to ensue, but only when you could start hearing bullets whizzing around your ears did you realise that it was something a lot more serious than firecrackers.
The Foreign Office says some attackers may still be at large. Travel companies offering tourists the chance to change their holiday bookings to Tunisia. Sean Tipton is from the Travel Association ABTA.
If you are due to fly out in the next day or two with one of our members, we'd recommend pretty strongly that you contact the tour operator concerned just to see what your options are. If you're travelling independently, you need to discuss that with your airline.
Four people have been arrested following a terror attack in France. A car was driven into a gas factory, causing an explosion before a decapitated body was found nearby. The suspect, Yassine Salih, his wife, sister and one other person are in custody following the attack near Lyon. The French Interior Minister is Bernard Casanueva.
We now know that the suspect's name could be Yassine Salih. This person was the subject of a security file for radicalisation in 2006. Which wasn't renewed in 2008. He didn't have a criminal record, and the investigation will give us more information about his profile.
In other news this evening, Barack Obama is in Charleston in South Carolina to deliver the eulogy at the funeral of a pastor killed in a racially motivated shooting at a church last week. He was one of nine who died. The US Supreme Court ruled in favor